We hope to spend time exploring those in more detail. What's another reason?
Well, we're told that Moses, nobody had ever had a relationship with God like Moses did. He saw him face to face. So that makes him a good example for our own relationships with God.
Okay, all right. We're going in reverse order. That's my second item. Exemplary character, right? The things that God has to say about Moses. It isn't just that, you know, some of these Old Testament characters, it's like, well, there's some good things and some bad things, and maybe we should follow this and maybe we shouldn't follow that. But God himself has many good things to say about Moses and his character. And so looking at those in details can help us try to emulate that, the things that he illustrates. Of course, he wasn't perfect. And I'm not just talking about the rock thing. There are some other flaws that we can find in his character. But we can learn from those too, can't we? He's a human being, and he has his shortcomings. And so we can relate to that and learn from his mistakes. Think of anything else?
He's one of the heroes of faith listed in Hebrews 11.
Okay, very good. Yeah, that kind of fits in my character category. But yeah, there's five verses in Hebrews 11 related to Moses and the things that he did that demonstrated his faith and the faith of his family. Anything else?
Also, because he's under a tremendous amount of pressure.
All right.
Like, I like the character things, but just all that lead pressure.
He's a crisis leader, isn't he? Just about everything that goes on in his life, there's some sort of emergency or some sort of, as you say, pressure being applied to Moses from all sorts of different directions. And how he handles that is really remarkable.
Similar to what Philip was saying, I was just thinking of how many difficult people he had to deal with, all the situations, and how he handled it with sometimes he handled it with boldness and sharpness, but a lot of times it was handled with grace where he interceded on behalf of the people.
Yeah.
And so learning how to deal with a nation that was so unrepentant, it would be beneficial, I think, for us to think about.
Absolutely. He had lots of difficult people to deal with, and he dealt with it very gracefully in most cases and stood up for them to the Lord in a number of situations. And got very little thanks for it, too, didn't he? He was generally not well-regarded in his own life. Even his own family, you know, rose up against in a rebellion to him. So he had opposition, and people were out to undercut him at every turn. And somehow he made it through all of that and still accomplished what God wanted him to accomplish.
Hey, well, David, if I could just quickly pile onto that, what's impressive even more is that he tried to avoid the responsibility.
Okay, yes. We're going to see that.
He was saying, I'm not the guy. And,
yes.
Look what happened.
Humility almost to a fault, you might say. And we'll look at that, I think, in a week from today when we look at the call that the Lord makes to him at the encounter of the burning bush. Well, we could go on for the whole class period probably talking about this. I'm going to have to kind of draw it to a close. The one other category I don't think it was really mentioned is he was just a major figure in history, right? Regardless of his character and what God did for him, the things he accomplished in his life, he was a prophet, a priest, and king. Those are the three things we often affiliate with Jesus. Not really a king in the royal sense, but he was the leader of the people, in addition to being a priest of the tribe of Levi and performing priestly roles, and certainly a spokesman for God as the lawgiver. He wrote the first five books of the Old Testament. Probably, I think, between him and Paul, I think he actually has more words maybe in the Bible written attributed to Moses than even the Apostle Paul. And of course, he was the lawgiver, the one through whom the law of Moses was delivered. We've already mentioned how he was an intercessor, a mediator, was a representative of the people before God, which is a very Christ-like role. He was a civil judge, established a system of courts, so to speak, during his time. He was a military commander. Before Joshua had complete charge of everything, he had to lead the people in battle. So he just was a man of great accomplishment and is a significant historical figure. And then, of course, his character, his meekness, humility, the faith that he's shown. He is called a servant of God, a friend of God, a man of God in the scriptures. And it's hard to top that. And then he's the forerunner of our Savior. And one key verse to think of in Deuteronomy 18 is where he's speaking to the people. This is toward the end, of course, of his life, where the Lord said, I will raise up a prophet from among their countrymen like you, Moses, and I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I command him. So here Moses is foretelling there will be another great prophet someday that the people will listen to. And we know from the New Testament, from preaching of the apostles in the book of Acts, Jesus Christ, the fulfillment of this. So he's very much a type of Christ. And there's a lot we can learn from that relationship. All right. So we have good reason. So let's get into it here. This is our plan. If you've got a lesson packet, either downloaded or printed it, these are the 13 lessons, the topics that we're going to take our roadmap through the life of Moses. You see it's sort of maybe a little front-loaded. Spend a little more time on the early life. His birth, preparation, the period of time when he was in the wilderness, the burning bush, the whole lesson about his encounter with God there, going back to Egypt to encounter Pharaoh, the famous story of the plagues that brought about the Exodus, that initial departure from Egypt, heading down to Mount Sinai, where they encamped and the things that happened there, and then a golden calf incident, the fallout that happened from the people's sin there at Sinai. Renewing the covenant and picking up the pieces from that disaster to move on. Lumping a lot of incidents of rebellion and complaining. It's hard to fit it all into one lesson, but there's plenty of that. We'll deal with that as a topic in lesson 10. They get to the land, which was the whole point of coming out of Egypt to begin with, and they fail to enter the land. What can we learn from Moses and his relationship to that episode? And then all of Deuteronomy is about preparing the next generation. After the 40 years of wilderness wandering, Moses plays a key role in helping the next generation accomplish the conquest that the prior generations had not, and to continue the covenant down through the years. And then the lesson of the death of Moses at the very end. So you don't see the tabernacle. There will be no group project to build a scale model of the tabernacle. If you were looking for that, you can do that on your own, but I'm not going to ask you to do that. No detailed walkthrough of the law and all the Levitical priesthood and all the sacraments. That's all in there. We're not going to take the time in this course to go through it. But we'll mention it as it's relevant to our study of this man's life. Okay, so your first question in your lesson sheet was to review how did we get here. So we're going to back up just a little bit before we get to Exodus, before we get to Moses, and remind ourselves of how the story opens when you pick up Exodus chapter 1. And I'm going to start back in Genesis chapter 12. We're not going to cover everything between Genesis 12 and Exodus 1. But Genesis 12 is where we meet Abram and see the promises that God made to him, the call of Abram. The Lord said, go forth from your country and your relatives and from your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great. You shall be a blessing, and I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you, I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth will be blessed. So we ask our kids, my wife and her fifth and sixth grade class did that just moments ago. What are the three promises that God made to Abraham? Anyone care to tell us?
Yeah, land, nation,
land, seed, and nation.
Very good, guys. You did your Sunday school. Yeah, land. To a land which I will show you, and I will make you a great nation, and in you all the families of the earth will be blessed. That's the seed promise. And the ultimate fulfillment of that, of course, is in Christ Jesus, isn't it? That's how we connect to this whole story. And part of what we hope to see in studying the life of Moses is how God works through the lives of these men, the events of history, to steer things toward his desired outcome, to bring our Savior into the world. And it all began here with Abraham and these three promises. The land in particular, if it's not clear, to your descendants I will give this land there in chapter 7 or verse 7 of chapter 12. And then Abram built a lot of altars, but after the Lord appeared to him there, this is after Abram did all this, right, and left his father's house and came into the land of Canaan and kind of went on a little tour of it there. The Lord promises again, this is the land and your descendants are to be the ones who are going to get that. So that's the premise. That's where things get started. But what happens almost immediately after that in chapter 12? Does anyone remember? Abraham has given up everything, left it all behind to come to this land to inherit God's promises.
Like a famine or something, right?
A famine, exactly. And that prompts this excursion to Egypt that we read about in the rest of chapter 12. There's this famine that occurs in the promised land. And for their own survival, it seems, to get food, Abram and his wife go to Egypt for relief, to get food. while they're there, of course, there's this whole misadventure with who is Sarah. So they come up with a story that she is Abram's sister, which is partly true, half sister, but kind of obscured the fact that he was actually his wife, which prompted Pharaoh. Apparently, Sarah was quite a looker, and he wanted to bring her into his harem or whatever it was the Egyptians had, become one of his own wives, which because of Sarah was so beautiful and Pharaoh was so happy with her, Pharaoh bestowed a whole lot of goodies on her brother, Abram, livestock, servants. That's what wealth was measured in those days. So Abram is greatly enriched by that, but the Lord strikes Pharaoh's house with a great plague. It says there in one of the verses there, verse 17, I think, because of Sarah. Apparently, it seems, if you study that chapter, that maybe Pharaoh didn't actually violate Sarah, but intended to, and perhaps this plague had prevented that from taking place. But eventually, Pharaoh figures out what's going on and why, and Abram's role in this, and perhaps in a bit of anger, says, take her and go, and by the way, take all your stuff with you. Now, my claim is, this whole story is the Exodus in microcosm, isn't it? What parallels do you see in this story with the whole Exodus story that we're about to study?
Start with Egypt.
Okay, it's going to Egypt for one thing. Egypt plays a key role in it. How did they get to Egypt? What put them down there?
Yeah, this famine.
There's a great famine. Did a famine play a role in why the Israelites were in Egypt in the book of Exodus? Yeah, it was the famine during Joseph's time, which we'll look at in a minute. That brought them down there, and that's why the family was there for food. So Abram goes there to get food. Then the whole business about the identity of Sarah is something else. But what happened to Pharaoh? If you back up a little bit and say that Pharaoh took Sarah to be his wife, and that was a bad thing. How might that be parallel to what's going on in Exodus? What is the Pharaoh doing to God's people in Exodus?
Yeah, taking them for his own.
Yeah, they're a free people, and he's enslaving them. Here he's taking Sarah and wants to make her his wife, which is improper and not something God would want. Pharaoh's sort of abusing God's people in some sort of way. And so what does God do in response to that? He sends great plagues upon Pharaoh and his household. And maybe, I don't think they're quite as great as the scales, what we'll see about in Exodus, but certainly with some sort of suffering, some sort of judgment from God upon the Pharaoh for his treatment of God's chosen people. That's what we see happening here with Abraham. That's what we see happening in Exodus. And when Pharaoh finally says, get out of here, we see the same thing in the Exodus story. What blessing comes with the exit that we stuff. See both in Abraham's case? And
stuff, lots of stuff.
Stuff, yeah, all this enrichment. Abraham left with a whole lot more stuff than he had. And of course, Lot was with him, it seems, and that leads to the story in chapter 13 where they have so much livestock that the land can't hold them all. But that happens to Israelites too, doesn't it? The Egyptians shower them with all sorts of material goods as they are about to leave the land. So in so many ways, this whole little excursion of just Abraham and his family going to Egypt in chapter 12, at the very beginning of their sojourn in the Promised Land, is a foreshadowing of what's going to happen in Exodus, which itself, as we'll see, is a foreshadowing of what happens to us spiritually in our deliverance from the bondage of sin. We'll talk about that as we go through the story. So that's Abram, the beginning. When you get to chapter 15, Abraham is in kind of Abram, don't call me too closely on that. I call him Abraham all the time. He's still Abram at this point. He's in a bit of a tough spot. He came back with Lot. Lot ended up taking the good part of the land for himself. And then Lot got swept up in some sort of international conflict where these coalition of kings comes in and takes a bunch of prisoners. And Abram has to rustle up a posse of people to go rescue him from capture and bring him back. And it cost him a lot of treasure and a lot of effort, and he's scared, basically. Chapter 15 opens with the Lord reassuring him not to fear. And furthermore, none of this whole promise business has worked out, right? The whole business about your descendants inheriting the side, there hasn't been descendant number one yet. It's still some Syrian slave that's in his household that would be his heir. So Abram's really sort of not upset, but just concerned about everything. He's been through a lot of harrowing experiences, and nothing seems to be moving forward. And he seeks out the Lord, or the Lord appears to him to reassure him that it's all going to work out. This is where he tells him to look at the stars in the picture. You see, look at the stars. If you can count the stars, you can count your descendants. But despite that reassurance, and despite the fact that he believed in the Lord and it was reckoned to him for righteousness, this is the chapter where that quote comes from, that episode. Abram has the question, O Lord God, how may I know that my descendants shall possess this land? Do you remember what unusual sort of arrangement the Lord set up for Moses or Abraham to give him that? Here's how you'll know. It's something to do with the picture, though I don't think the picture here is really accurate for the way it's set up. What does the Lord tell Abraham to do in that chapter? You want to remember? This wasn't in your lesson sheet. I really am pulling on your memory.
This is the weird story where he like cuts animals in half and walks between them and stuff.
Yeah, and the sun's going down and he's having to like ward off all the vultures that are coming to eat the animals. Yeah, that's that story. And it's the idea, as I understand it, this is a covenant sacrifice. This is a way even two people would make some sort of agreement, binding agreement. They'd cut an animal in half and set the two halves opposite each other and then walk between them as if to say, so shall become of us if we break this agreement or something. We'll be cutting it. Seems to be the idea behind it. But Abraham here is trying to make a covenant with God who cannot be seen. But as the night arrives after staving off all the birds of prey, Abram eventually sees the smoking oven and flaming torch that's moving between the animals there. And that's sort of the reassurance, a sign from God that he is entering this covenant and will make good on what he's promised. But in the middle of that, okay, between the setting up of the animals and the vision of the torch and the oven, he has this terrifying nightmare. He falls asleep. He goes into the sleep and he has this vision. And God says to him, know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. But I will also judge the nation whom they will serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions. As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried at a good old age. Then the fourth generation, they will return here, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete. Any idea what he's talking about there? Yes, it's the Exodus story. So what three key elements do we see mentioned here that we're going to see in the Exodus that in some ways we've already seen in Abram's own life when he was in Egypt? Maybe not the 400 years of oppression, but there's certainly oppression is going to come for 400 years. But what is God going to do after that?
Judgment on the nation.
I'm sorry?
Judgment on the nation.
Judgment, thank you, yes. So judgment's part of this, right? It isn't just free my people, let my people go, but the Egyptians are going to be judged. Part of the whole process of the plagues was not just to demonstrate God's power, though that was part of it. It was time for Egypt to be judged for what they have done to God's people and what they have done in disobedience to God. So judgment will be coming as part of that, just like it was for Pharaoh when Abram was there. And then again, this idea of the many possessions, right? That seems to be a key part of all this, that there will be a blessing in material sense when they come out from this judgment after this oppression. But this gives Abram more insight than he's ever had. The longest term view in terms of specifics of how this is all going to unfold. Still very generic. He doesn't say who the nation is, but you're talking 400 years. That's well beyond Abraham's lifespan. So he knows this is going to happen long after he's gone. And he will be buried at a good old age and won't get to see any of this come to pass. But is that a very comforting scenario? Yeah, your descendants are going to get this land, but first, they're going to be slaves for four centuries here. They're going to be enslaved and oppressed, and God will have to exercise great judgment. and punishment on the nation that oppresses them in order for them to come out and come to this land. Furthermore, talking about judgment, it's not just judgment on the Israel Egyptians. Who else is going to be judged as part of this whole plan? The iniquity of the Amorites, so the locals here, that where Abram's living now, the Canaanite nation, they were all pagan peoples. And part of the whole plan here is to exercise judgment upon them. It isn't just, I want to give this land to my people. That is part of the process, but he's also driving out these others and punishing them for their iniquity and their rebellion against God. So judgment on both ends of the process, on Egypt and on the Canaanites, will all be part of God's multi-century plan here to bring Abram's promises to fruition and giving him a great nation that would occupy the land that he has promised to him. So this is all foreshadowing, all foretelling of the coming Exodus story. And then the last story we'll look at is the story of Joseph. We don't have time to go into
David.
All of the story there. But yes, sir.
Well, I was just on your previous slide. That was amazing to me to think about, like, God's sense of timing as they're like waiting for descendant number one, as you put it.
Yes.
That the God's like, oh, by the way, I've got the next 400 years already in the bag. And
exactly.
Like our country is barely a little over half of that.
Right.
You know, and it's two verses.
Exactly. Yes, it is amazing. It's amazing. It's special to Abraham that he got that bit of a glimpse, right? That he even was able to know that. But to have this assurance that God has a plan, it's a long-term plan. I'm only going to live to see a little tiny piece of it, but to know that he has it all mapped out is interesting to be sure. Well, the story of Joseph, we won't go into the story of how he gets to Egypt, but we know that once he's there and Pharaoh has this curious dream and this prisoner is... Hebrew prisoner is able to interpret his dreams about the 7 years of plenty followed by the 7 years of famine. Joseph then is elevated to be second in the kingdom only to Pharaoh. And his task is to prepare during these 7 years of plenty to store up the food so that they'll be ready when the famine hits to survive, not only as the Egyptians, but for the rest of the world. And in fact, when the famine years come, Joseph's brothers, the other sons of Israel, have to go to Egypt to get food. And by the way, this was a real moneymaker for the pharaohs as well. Keep that in mind. The taxes and the charges they were able to make enriched the pharaoh. So pharaoh's really benefiting from his relationship with Joseph here. Not just their own survival of the famine, but it's been a boon to their whole economic system. Did someone have a comment or have I heard something? Okay. And of course, eventually Joseph and his brothers are reunited. We won't go into that story. And they kiss and make up, as it were. And he invites his entire family to come and live with him there in Egypt. His father, Jacob, Israel, eventually dies in Egypt. And then they have this great caravan. They go back to the land of Israel and bury him there. But the family lives in the land of Goshen in the time of Egypt. And that brings us up to Exodus chapter 1 and our lesson for tonight, or today. The oppression of Israel that we see going on in Egypt. So if you're not there already, you can look at Exodus chapter 1 and follow along as we walk through just the first chapter, really, of the book of Exodus. By the time you flip the page, right, from the end of Genesis to Exodus, you've skipped ahead almost that 400 years. There's quite a gap there. What do we see happening with the Israelites in verse 7 by the time this book begins? What have they done from that 70, 75 people they started with? By verse 7, they've become innumerable, right? Fruitful and multiplied. They increased greatly and they became exceedingly mighty, so the land was filled with them. Which became a concern for the Pharaoh. The key verse in chapter 1, or one key verse, is verse 8. This new king arises. There probably had been several new kings between the time of Joseph and the time of the Exodus. But what specifically does the Bible say about this new king in verse 8?
He didn't know who Joseph was.
This new king arises who did not know Joseph. Now, what do we mean? By no, they'd never heard of him. Possibly. It's been 400 years, but do we see other situations in the Bible and even in our own lives where as time passes, things that once were important and significant and things you thought about a lot, you don't think about them so much anymore. And the things that made those things so valuable in the past aren't as relevant anymore. So whatever great love may have exist between Pharaoh and the Israelites back when Joseph saved the nation and saved the world from famine. That famine was a long time ago, and no one's thinking about that anymore. He didn't know anything about Joseph and the special relationships that the royal family had with him there. And furthermore, if I can get my clicker there, now these Hebrews aren't just 70, 75. They are a multitude of people, and they're concerned about how many of them there are and how strong they're becoming. And there's possible military concern that he expresses here in verse 10. Maybe he's being a little bit paranoid, but did the Egyptians fight a lot of wars with other nations? It seems to happen a lot. So his concern here is that they're going to multiply, and if there's a war, they're going to align themselves with those who hate us, with our enemies, and they're going to fight against us, and that would be a bad thing. And one thing that caught my eye this time around through the story, what concern does he have at the very end of verse 10?
David, that caught me too for the first time.
Okay. Reading,
and I think it's because you enumerated things. He's concerned they'll go up out of the land right here from the beginning.
Yeah. It's like, what would happen to us if these folks left us? Which almost suggests to me that this seems to be before the enslavement policy came along, right? These were a large number of people living in the land. And I'm sure there was some kind of economic output going on. These people were either farming or raising cattle or doing something with themselves. They weren't just, relaxing up there. They performed some sort of service for the Egyptians. There was some relationship there between them. And if they were to leave of their own accord for whatever reason, in the eyes of the Egyptians, that would be a bad thing. That would cause some sort of diminishment for them if these folks were ever to depart from the land. So from the beginning, he's trying to do what he can to keep them from leaving. But are the things that the Pharaoh does to try to keep them to stay, are they going to succeed in helping them remain? Or are they actually going to end up driving them further away? That adds fuel to the fire. So we're going to see in a number of ways that the thing Pharaoh is trying to do is going to backfire in many ways and blow up in his face. So his concern about the people leaving, see, it was also a part of his decision-making here. What do we see the Egyptians do to counter this problem? Verse 11 and 12. It's time
work
for this forced labor, the taskmasters over them to give them some sort of hard labor. And they mentioned a couple specific storage cities that they built. But if the concern had been numbers and might of the people, and if the solution was, well, if we make them work really, really hard, that will diminish their numbers or at least slow down their numbers. But what actually happens in verse 12? The greater the affliction, the more they multiplied. So it only seemed to increase things. It seems, again, to backfire on him. And furthermore, the dread of the Egyptians that they had only got worse. This was our solution to make things better, and it's making the situation worse. And then verses 13 and 14, talking about how they compelled them with hard labor to labor rigorously. Now, it's not clear to me whether this is just a summary of the labor, but it almost reads like it's an escalation. Like maybe they started with certain tasks that we're going to force you to do in building these cities. That didn't seem to work. So now we're going to make it maybe a little harder on you, because we're going to make you make the bricks and all kinds of field labor. And maybe they just found more ways to try to beat them down with labor that was more and more difficult. We'll see that later when Moses returns and starts dealing with Pharaoh, that they found ways to up their quota. They found ways to make the slave life even harder than it was for the people. So maybe this was a first instance of that. But did that work? That doesn't seem to have completely solved the problem either. So now we see the evil plan of Pharaoh hatched. There's really no other way to describe it. Who does he turn to first to help with his population control scheme?
Midwives.
The midwives of the Hebrews themselves. And the two of them are named by name. Likely they were like the chief midwives. I'm sure they had a whole crew of midwives that were involved in helping the Hebrew women give birth to their children. But he directs them to, if you see the newborn is a male, go ahead and put him to death right there. Let the daughters live. There's a lot of speculation why the males and not the females. We won't go into all that speculation, but certainly that would help keep the numbers down if you start killing babies like that, not only in the near term, but perhaps in the long term. Did the midwives go off and say, yes, sir, we'll do just what you say? Absolutely not. It says they feared God instead of obeying Pharaoh. They let the boys live. And when the Pharaoh challenges them on that, why are you not carrying out what I told you to do? They have an explanation. What's their explanation?
The Hebrew woman very vigorous in childbirth, and before they get there, the child's born.
You just don't know what the Hebrews are like. You know how the Egyptian ladies give birth, all right? But these Egyptian ladies, they are vigorous, I think is the word that's used there. The babies pop out before we can get there. You know, they go into labor, and they call for us, and we rush in there. But, you know, the baby's already born. I'm sorry we missed the window of opportunity to put to death the child when they're on the stone there. That seems to be the birthing stone, whatever contraption they had, whatever setup they have to help give birth. That's when the midwife would come in. But if babies are born before we can get there, there's nothing we can do about that. How does God react? Well, first of all, do you think that was the whole truth about why? Probably not.
I don't think so.
Yeah. I think it's more, as I said in the passage, they feared God. They did not obey the king. And this may be the cover story, but what does God say to them about it? The scripture says that God was good to them because they feared God. He established households for them, gave them families. Maybe that was something that midwives did not normally do. I don't know. But and he continued to bless the people. The whole thing that Pharaoh was trying to prevent, the expansion of the numbers of the Israelites was thwarted because they continued to multiply. Does God commend their lying necessarily, if you want to call it that, their cover story? That's not the issue. The issue is they didn't do this horrible thing that Pharaoh was ordering them to do, and kept the babies alive. Well, if there's some jobs that if you want it done right, you just have to do it yourself. He can't rely on the Hebrew midwives anymore to carry out his infanticide orders. Who does he turn to next? At the very end of the chapter, we see he commands all of his people to cast their newborn sons into the Nile. Pretty sure he's targeting this toward the Hebrews. That's the target population he's trying to thin out. But the way it's worded, at least in the English, he commanded all his people to cast the newborn. So I don't know if that means all of his servants, all of his Egyptian people, be on the lookout for Hebrew male newborn, that if you find any, dump them in the river. That is the decree, that is policy. Or whether it was even more broad than that. There was a king in the New Testament we learn about that had a pretty broad edict for killing babies, just to make sure he got the one he was interested in killing. Maybe that was overborne, but at least the Hebrews were under this edict that their children were to be cast into the Nile. So it's not just the midwives at the point of birth. You find a Hebrew baby, you dump them in the river, and that was the law of the land, at least for a time. I tried to figure out if we had any indication how long this edict was in place, and I haven't been able to find any sort of reference to indicate that one way or the other. Yes.
I was going to say on that point, one commentator pointed out that this edict probably was not in place when Aaron was born, Moses' mm-hmm. older brother. And if it had continued in effect for, 86 years or however long it is until Moses gets back, right, presumably there wouldn't have been as many Israelites as there ended up being.
Exactly.
So his conclusion was it must have been fairly short-lived.
I doubt it was very long-lived. It would be difficult to enforce and probably – you even sort of see from the reaction of Pharaoh's daughter that it's just a very inhumane thing to carry out for anybody. So this probably didn't last for very long, but this was the circumstance when Moses was born. So that's we're setting the stage for the birth of Moses here, which we need to go through kind of quickly here. It's a fairly well-known story to us here in the first 10 verses of chapter 2. The first thing that happens is that Moses' parents, Amram and Jochebed, they're not named here, but we learn their names elsewhere. She has a newborn, and she hides him for 3 months. Why did he hide him?
Cute kid.
Well, my first instinct is, wouldn't you try? I mean, wouldn't any parent have a child in this circumstance do something to try to save the life of their baby? I doubt there were very many Hebrews that said, well, here's the new law of the land. You know, when the kid's born, if he's a boy, we got to dump him in the river, and we'll just do that, no questions asked. But there did seem, from what's said in Exodus and what Stephen says in Acts chapter 7, and even what the Hebrew writer says in chapter 11, about this child, that he was a cutie. He was beautiful. He was lovely in the sight of God, Stephen says. There was something about his appearance, his personality. He had a certain charm about him. I don't know. There was just some magnetism about this kid that made him seem extra special, because every parent thinks that their newborn is very special. But in some ways, perhaps, even this Moses child was above that in some sort of way. And maybe that helped to give his parents a little extra nudge to reach out in faith and try to do something to save their child and not give in to Pharaoh. You see in this family portrait here, I think that's Aaron, the older brother, and this is Miriam over here, the big sister, with baby Moses there. So what scheme do they come up with? She makes a basket, wicker basket, some translations, it's probably made out of papyrus reeds and cover it with tar and pitch to make it waterproof, I suppose. They put the baby into this little basket. I think the same word that is translated ark in the Noah story is used here. It's the same sort of concept. And set it out among the reeds in the river. And did they leave it unattended? They just walk away and say, that's it, we'll just leave everything and the hand of fate to go somewhere. Miriam was tasked to follow along from a distance. I don't know how much travel there was of the basket, but we know that shortly thereafter, verse 5, the daughter of Pharaoh is down by the Nile with her maidens walking there, and they see the basket, and she sends one of her maids to go get the basket and bring it in. Opens the basket and finds the baby, charming little baby, crying little baby. She has pity on the baby and recognizes, of course, it comes from the Hebrews. This is one of the Hebrew children that's under the edict of being put to death. Who pops in then? Marty, did you have a question? Yes. Comment. You're on mute still. There you go.
Question. It is, does the fact that she puts him in the river, is that connected at all to the command that they were supposed to cast him in the river?
So maybe trying to adhere to the letter of the law?
Yeah, I mean, some of the ways in which babies were killed was by exposure, right?
And yes.
So it didn't quite have to be so direct and bloody. That, but maybe there's a way to say, hey, we just did what you said, if they were caught, that is.
That could be. And I think the way Stephen phrases it, there's something about the Pharaoh forced them to expose the babies or something. There's a nuance there that suggests this idea of death by exposure. So maybe this was just her way of trying to do that. If they were caught and they were just saying, we did what you said, but with some variations there.
Isn't that kind of similar to what you pointed out with Abraham, that when he's there with Sarai, he's kind of leaning on some technicalities?
Yes.
And the midwives are leaning on some technicalities. And now yes. They're like, everybody's just trying to skirt through the loopholes.
Yes. Just trying to, yes. Thread the needle there very carefully. That may be what's going on here. But who appears right there with a proposal when Pharaoh's daughter finds the baby? It's Miriam, right? The sister. She doesn't say, I'm the sister, elder sister of the child here, but she says, hey, you know, I know a good Hebrew nurse. You know, if you're interested in this child, we can find a nurse. No decision, apparently, from what I can read, has been made about what she's going to do with this baby when she finds it. And maybe Miriam is kind of planting a seed in her mind, you know, I could I could get one of the Hebrews to come and nurse this baby if you're interested. And she tells her to go find it. And, of course, she brings the mother of the child, Jochebed, to serve in that role. And Pharaoh's daughter hires her, pays her wages to raise her own baby, but under the understanding that he would become adopted into Pharaoh's household. It's actually Pharaoh's daughter that gives him the name, because I drew him out of the water. The root name of Moses seems to signify that. I almost get the sense that maybe Miriam, I don't know if she worked for Pharaoh's daughter, had some sort of connection. Maybe she was just a slave girl that popped in out of the woodwork, you know, just at that particular time. But the fact that Pharaoh's daughter was willing to send her to get a nurse and all that seems a little bit out of place to me, unless there was some previous connection there. May also have been that this was sort of a target, that when they put the basket in there, that maybe this was the desired outcome, that they were trying to steer it that way, and just we'll step back and just let things happen and see what results. But certainly we could claim that there's some providential dimension to what's going on here, because this child certainly has been brought into the world for some specific purposes, and the circumstances of his birth are now positioning him, and we'll talk about this next time, positioning him to learn the things he's going to need to know to do the job that God has for him. It's unlikely that any old Hebrew slave could have risen up and do the kinds of things that Moses did. But because he's going to be born into Pharaoh's household now and raised there, he will have opportunity to learn some things and accomplish some things that will serve him later on. We'll talk about that later. All right, we are out of time, but I got one more slide. One more slide. So Moses is the forerunner of our Savior. That's our theme. I gave you your lesson sheet, a few verses to look at. Did anyone find some parallels between what's happening here in this story of the birth of Moses and what we know about the birth of Jesus a couple thousand years later?
I can get us started off if you want.
Please do.
All right. Both of them faced the threat of being killed when they were babies.
Very good. Born under a decree of death. It was Herod in the case of Jesus who was concerned that this king of the Jews was being born. And it was geographically limited. I think it was Bethlehem. But yeah, he had a decree that if you're under two, any male under the age of two had to be killed. Very good. What else? I have to admit, I went through my own lesson sheet, and some of them seemed a little obscure if I just went by the verses. So.
There's a connection to Egypt?
Definitely a connection to Egypt. And I'll just walk through this here. Both of them were rescued from the decree that they were born under. In the case of Moses, his parents had the faith to trust in God, to not obey the king and to save their child, and they put him in this basket. In the case of Joseph and Mary, they were directed by God to go into Egypt and stay there until Herod died. And so both of those actions protected the child from the decree of death that they were under. And yes, they both involve Egypt. Of course, Moses was born in Egypt. Jesus ended up in Egypt for a time when he was a child. So there's almost an inverse parallel there, or maybe a reflection of sort. Moses later, when he's 40, leaves Egypt and has to stay away out of Egypt until the Pharaoh who was about to get him had died and it was safe for him to return. In Jesus' case, he goes into Egypt and stays there as a place of refuge until Herod, the king that was out to get him, died and it was safe for him to return. Both cases, they're leaving their homeland and waiting till they can come back. Anyone think of anything else?
At the birth of Jesus, there was a taxation over the
Okay.
At the time of Moses, there was an exact analogy of slavery, right?
Yes, exactly. The analogy is foreign oppression. That was the parallel you were supposed to get. And it's a bit of a stretch, but yes. The Israelites were being oppressed by the Egyptians, and yeah, slavery. Taxation, maybe not quite the best example, but they lived under Roman rule. So a foreign land was ruling over the people of Israel, God's people at that time. I doubt the Roman oppression was quite as severe as what the Egyptian oppression became, but both are definitely involved. Anything else? I got a couple more.
I got another one. Yep. Both of them had to basically, or both of them were teaching, well, Moses was teaching the law and Jesus was teaching salvation, but basically they were both having to deal with an unfaithful people.
Definitely, yes. And in their ministry, they had people had to deal with people who were not faithful to the Lord in different ways and had to be corrected, had to be taught. But to finish up just the birth parallels, at the time of their birth, they were both royal, both born into royalty, or they became part of royal families. The lineage of Jesus through David, the great king. The